Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Guardian.
Hello, I'm John Henley, and this is Brexit Means, the podcast trying ceaselessly to make some kind of sense of something we all know makes very little sense indeed since approximately 1784, or at least that's what it's starting to feel like. Anyway, in this episode, European election meltdown looms for Britain's two biggest political parties. Nigel attains nirvana. What on earth does Theresa do next? Or, to be strictly accurate, will she be around long enough to decide? And, of course, what the hell are Labour playing at, part 2421? Also, what do the EU27 make of it all now that Brexit has effectively and definitively descended into a very British farce? And can we all maintain our sanity? All this and more over the next 40 minutes. Can't wait. So, a quick rundown on what's happened since we last met. The Tories and Labour, the former still officially backing Brexit and the latter still not really quite sure, did really very badly in local elections, while the Lib Dems and the Greens, both explicitly pro-Remain, did very well. Polls predict that pattern will repeat itself in the European parliamentary elections on May the 23rd and 26th, which the UK is obliged to hold because it hasn't managed to sort Brexit out in time to avoid them. Except that this time, Nigel Farage's month-old Brexit party, which didn't take part in the local vote, looks set to sweep all before it. It's currently heading for 34%. That's more than Labour and the Lib Dems combined, and much more than Labour and the Tories combined. That's because the Conservatives are on course to finish in fifth place, behind the Brexit Party, behind Labour, the Lib Dems, and yes, even the Greens. Meanwhile, Brexit talks between the government and Labour have been going nowhere fast, mainly because any concessions the Prime Minister makes to Labour on, for example, a customs agreement or a second confirmatory public vote may win May some MPs from Her Majesty's opposition, but it will almost certainly lose her at least as many on her own Conservative benches. And senior cabinet ministers are now reportedly pushing her to drop them altogether. There's still some vague talk of the PM trying to bring her thrice-defeated Brexit deal back to Parliament before the European election, and rumours that she could try for another series of indicative votes in a last-ditch attempt to forge some kind of consensus in Westminster. But she's also now under increasingly heavy pressure from her own party to step down sooner rather than later, and certainly many observers don't see how she can survive long after those forecast catastrophic election results next week. In Brussels, finally, Donald Tusk, the president of the European Council, reckons the chances of Brexit not happening at all could now be as high as 30%. So, where does Britain's noble effort to free itself from the shackles of a dying bloc and skip joyously towards the sunlit uplands go from here? With me to ponder that vital question are in the studio Simon Usherwood of the academic think tank UK in a Changing Europe and Sonia Soda, chief leader writer on The Observer and deputy opinion editor at The Guardian. And on the line from Brussels, as ever, Guardian correspondent Jennifer Rankin. Welcome to all of you, and thanks for joining us. Let's start with those local and European elections in the UK, shall we, Simon? It certainly looks like the Conservatives and Labour are really being hammered for their dithering and delay and confusion on Brexit, and parties that are unambiguously for Remain, or at least for a second vote, are being rewarded. Is it really that simple?
that's how those parties are going to portray it as being. But I think the picture is always more complex than that. And clearly these are local elections. And as much as we know a lot of voters vote on national politics, local issues do matter. And we see that with a rise not just in parties that have positions on Brexit, but also on local issues. So I live in Guildford. There you've seen the council move to no overall control, largely because of the collapse of the Conservative vote, but going not just to Lib Dems, but also to a local residents group who have no views whatsoever about Brexit, if you can imagine that such people exist. So there is a different dynamic, and we're seeing that in the contrast between the local elections and what we're going to see with these European elections, which I think are going to give a quite different kind of pattern.
Okay, what sort of way?
Well, I think there, in these European elections, we're going to see much more about people's views about Brexit, which, again, is ironic because MEPs don't really have a role in the Brexit process. We know the European Parliament will have to approve a withdrawal agreement, but that really is a secondary concern to what is the UK going to do one way or the other. So people aren't voting on what these MEPs actually might do in terms of a direct effect. Mm-hmm. It's more about how those parties might then shape what happens here in the UK and where we might go from there.
Okay. Sonia, on the European elections, I mean, the polls are now showing that something like 60% of Conservative voters are ready to vote for Farage's Brexit party, which obviously wants a no-deal Brexit. It's understandable they would do that, I suppose. But it also looks like large numbers of Labour voters could abandon Jeremy Corbyn's party, most of them for an alternative that explicitly backs Remain or at least a second vote. Has the time not come for Labour to really come clean and say where it finally stands on Brexit?
I think it has, absolutely. And I think it has for two reasons. First of all, I think it's sort of strategy of constructive ambiguity where it doesn't it sort of sits on the fence, sits in the middle of the road, doesn't really sort of, it tries to fudge its position. I just don't think that that's sustainable anymore. I think voters really want to know what Labour stands for on Brexit. I mean, it's the most important question facing the country, arguably, for decades. And our main opposition party seems to basically still be maintaining its fudge position. I also think it's right that the party says what it stands for because, you know, voters have a right to know. They're going in and voting on these elections. It's not really good enough to have a position that says, you know, we're in favour of a Labour negotiated Brexit, which isn't really on the table. And if not, then we're in favour of a general election, which Labour doesn't really have the votes to trigger in Parliament. And then if not, maybe we'll consider a confirmatory referendum. It's very hard for voters to know, well, what exactly
what
does
I
that
do?
Mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it absolutely is right for Labour to come clean. There's a couple of things holding it back. One is that, you know, its sort of fudge strategy probably isn't that sustainable anymore with voters. But then in picking whether it is a Remain and Reform party and in favour of a confirmatory referendum or a sort of soft Brexit party, it's going to lose votes either way. So I think it will lose more votes. And this is what the polling suggests. It suggests that it will lose more votes if it's seen as a Brexit party than a Remain and Reform party. But, you know, it's going to lose some votes either way. So the party clearly doesn't want to do that. So people are holding off that. And then the second reason Labour really hasn't come clean is because the shadow cabinet is utterly divided. I mean, it's a split as the Tories. So you've got, you know, shadow cabinet members like Tom Watson, Emily Thornberry, Keir Starmer, who are very clearly supportive of a confirmatory referendum now. And you've had, they make noises in the last couple of days, really significant interventions, essentially saying, you know, there just aren't the Labour MPs who would back, a withdrawal agreement unless there was a confirmatory referendum attached. But then on the other side, you know, you've got people who, like John Trickett, for example, who are much more hardline, and you know, a confirmatory referendum is the last thing they want to see. So this is why Labour have continued with this fudge strategy, and it's kind of hard to see how it resolves itself because of that shadow cabinet split.
Simon, just before we move on, one last word on those polls. Are they not kind of showing the European election polls, at least, are they not basically showing that, you know, the problem of the two main parties, and we'll talk more about this later, but the two main UK parties is essentially that, you know, if you're a Leave voter, you can't really vote for the Conservatives anymore because they're not delivering it. And if you're a Remain voter, you can't really vote for Labour because, you know, Labour doesn't know where it stands either. And so you're forced to the extremes.
Yeah, I think that the unsatisfactory nature of both parties' policies does clearly push away voters. And you know, we know that people identify more with a Leave versus a Remain identity as opposed to a party political identity, that the identification is much stronger these days. So that does tend to get people to think more in those kind of terms. But what's interesting is that you've got that fracture on both sides of the Leave and the Remain debate, that with parties that do have clear positions that don't necessarily benefit very strongly. And I think you see that more on the Remain side, where you've got three distinct parties that have got an offer that is pretty much the same, and yet they can't quite bring themselves together. And I think this is maybe the problem, that the European elections are important as a signal, but there's a signal for what comes next in British politics. And we'll talk about that now.
Is this exactly
a new era?
That's really interesting. Thanks. Jennifer, now, at the last European Council in Brussels, when the EU27 granted Britain a further Brexit extension, obviously till October the 31st, Donald Tusk really went out of his way to implore Britain not to waste any more time in getting on with the process. Now, how do Brussels and the other capitals view what you can only call as a complete lack of progress on Brexit in London? Or have they got more important things to worry about?
I think the overwhelming feeling, both from the EU institutions and from the EU 27 member states, is just relief that they don't have to talk about Brexit anymore, at least not for a few weeks and months. And last week we really saw that at an EU summit. I was in Sibiu, in this very picturesque Transylvanian city, where EU leaders gathered for a special summit. So it was a summit without Theresa May that had actually been called back in 2017, and the idea was to relaunch the EU after Brexit. Of course, Brexit hasn't happened yet, but the EU still went ahead with that summit, and they very much wanted to show that the EU is united, the EU is moving forward without the UK. So we had this elaborate sort of declaration, that 10 points of unity, which you could see as like the EU's new 10 commandments. And Brexit was really the subject that nobody wanted to talk about. It was very sort of obvious in the press conference at the end that there were no British journalists were asked to or called to ask questions. So despite the fact some of us were sitting in the front row and very keen to do so. And then we caught Donald Tusk at the end of the press conference and said, "So did you discuss Brexit then?" And he said, "No, oof, no." And he gave a little smile and he started sort of walking very quickly to the exit. And he was also asked, "So do you think the UK is making good use of the time, you know, based on what he'd said a few weeks earlier?" And he smiled a bit and he said, "It's a very good question." So I don't think we can read too much into that. But I think it's very early days and the EU will be reserving judgment. I think there's a lot of scepticism about the cross-party talks and about seeing any results from them anytime soon. But I think for now, the EU are sort of happy to sit back, not get too involved in the details, but just wait and see what happens. And they really do hope that there will be an outcome from this. They would like Labour and the Conservatives to get a deal that would mean the UK could leave on time at the end of October. But I think there's scepticism about that date. But really, EU attention now turning to other questions, the EU's own big transition year, which I think we'll talk about soon. But there's a lot going on in the EU with the elections coming up at the end of this month, beginning to talk about who will take over from Jean-Claude Juncker at the Commission and from Donald Tusk at the Council. So these are the kind of things that are actually really dominating people's
preoccupying
attention
the EU
rather
now.
Than Brexit.
Yeah, right. So what Simon, Jennifer mentioned, obviously, those cross-party talks underway for a good few weeks now, trying to reach some kind of consensus with Labour that might get a majority in the House of Commons. Now, you know, I mean, if the Conservatives are going to reject any kind of plan for a customs arrangement, which is apparently what they're saying, and Labour won't go for a deal that doesn't have a customs arrangement, why is Theresa May persisting?
It's a very good question. It's been the very perplexing thing about these talks from the off. You know, we're, what, 5 weeks, six weeks into these, and it's not as if the issues aren't very clear. It's not as if everyone's preferences and red lines aren't very clear. And yet we carry on dragging this out. Now, I think that the reason for persisting is that everyone wants to show that they've tried their hardest and that sadly the other lot, you know, put the kibosh on it. So I think this is really, it's essentially a covering of backsides. And it's there to show that, you know, we're trying hard in the national interest, imagine air quotes for that, but no, there's no real expectation that this can produce a consensus. The problem, I think, is also it shows the disconnection between leaderships in both parties and the backbenches, that what might work for the leaders isn't going to work for the backbenches, and that cuts both ways for both parties.
Sonia, you nodding in agreement there. And also this question, I mean, you touched on it earlier, but I mean, are we right to sort of see two main obstacles, one being the customs agreement and the other being this idea of a confirmatory referendum or a second vote, essentially the problem being that, you know, that the as much as Theresa May gives in order to win votes from Labour, she's going to lose them from the Conservatives.
I mean, that's absolutely right. And I think you just won't get Labour MPs supporting this. I mean, there's no way that Jeremy Corbyn's going to strike a deal with Theresa May, I think, if he's got any political savvy whatsoever. Because first of all, Jeremy Corbyn won't be able to, there's nothing binding about any offers that Theresa May makes Labour on the withdrawal agreement, and, you know, everything about the future relationship, you know, that's the mood music of the political declaration. It's not legally binding. We all know Theresa May's not going to stick around. We all know Brexity Tory leadership candidates like Boris Johnson, they've actually said explicitly now they're not going to be held to any deal that Theresa May strikes with Jeremy Corbyn. So, I mean, it's not worth the paper it's written on. So, you know, you're not going to... And then Jeremy Corbyn, if he were to strike a deal and it were to go through Parliament and then you don't get Labour MPs backing in sufficient numbers, which is extremely likely to happen, then it sort of looks like, you know, Labour MPs. Exactly. So there's no way Jeremy Corbyn's going to strike a deal on this, I think. The only way you could potentially see numbers come through from some sort of compromise would be if you took Theresa May's deal as it stands and you attach a confirmatory vote to it. You could see potentially maybe you could build numbers in Parliament that if you maintain support of sufficient numbers of Conservative MPs who've already voted for Theresa May's deal and then bring a whole bunch of Labour MPs on board. But it's quite difficult because a confirmatory referendum might put sufficient numbers of Tories off. And also, we know Jeremy Corbyn doesn't really want a referendum. Yeah. Loads of his MPs want one. Jeremy Corbyn doesn't want one. So it's... You know, I think the chances of some sort of deal going through, whether that's Theresa May's deal, whether it's some sort of soft Brexit deal, whether it's Theresa May's deal with a confirmatory referendum attached, is just very, very hard to see it happening, which does really beg the question, what on earth is going to happen
next? Absolutely. Well, that oddly enough, we're going to talk about that. Jennifer, from what Simon and Sonia were saying, it really sounds unlikely, but let's just assume, for the sake of argument, for a second, that some kind of agreement is reached at Westminster. Now, Theresa May has said she would then go back to the EU and seek changes to the political declaration, although not the withdrawal agreement itself. Now, I mean, the EU would presumably be more than happy to go along with that, I imagine.
Yes, very, very much so. And Michel Barnier has said several times that's a relatively easy thing to do. And EU officials say, you know, it could be done in hours, in a few days. We're not even talking about the work of weeks here. This is something that the EU sees as relatively straightforward. But the sort of technical aspects of rewriting the political declaration are one thing, but what they see as the big political hurdle, that they just don't see a consensus for a customs union in the UK. I mean, even though the Ken Clark proposal came very close to winning support in the House of Commons a few weeks ago, it didn't get that support. And I think there's scepticism that it will anytime soon. So the onus and the question is really on the UK side, and for the EU, it's something that would be, you know, relatively straightforward to do.
Right. Simon, where does the deal go from here? The Theresa May's deal? I mean, is it, can we safely say it's dead in the water? There's some talk of indicative votes maybe after the European elections. Would that, I mean, that hasn't worked before. Might it work now?
Everyone loves a good indicative vote, don't they? there's no reason to think that anything has changed. You know, it's Theresa May's line. Nothing has changed. And that's the problem. I think the difficulty is here that it's clear that there is not a majority in support of Theresa May's deal, but there is even less support for leaving with no deal. And Parliament blocks itself into this impasse because it rejects options and then has no options left because it also doesn't have a majority for remaining. And so those are the three options. Leave with a deal, leave without a deal, don't leave. And you have literally nothing else you can do apart from ask for some more time. And I think the danger now in the system is that because we've had two extensions to Article 50 to take us out to October at the longest, is that, well, we can always have some more time. And I think, you know, as Jennifer could say, and Sonia too, you know, at some point somebody's going to say enough. You know, we can't keep on giving more time just for going around the same options and saying the same things time and again. This actually
something does need to change.
And the problem is, what can change? And this is, I think, maybe where we come into questions about a general election. But the people who would most obviously benefit from a general election are the people who are least able to get it. And the people who are most likely to suffer from it, the Conservatives, are the ones who are least likely for exactly that reason to call it. Yeah. So either we hang around until May 2020, for the end of the parliament.
What a thought!
God help us.
Still having the same conversation in two
and,
years.
And
time.
I think that's the question: is, you know, do you end up accidentally getting to that, or do you try and hurry the system along? And of course, the problem with the general election is, as we know from previous general elections, is they don't turn out the way you think they will. Right. So there's no guarantee at all in a general election that it results. No. You may end up with exactly the same. Well, problem, but with a different set of actors, you know, Jeremy Corbyn with a minority government or a coalition or just some other problem. And still any new government still has those three choices.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, well, precise. I mean, Sonia, again, you were nodding along. I mean, Theresa May is due to meet the 1922 Committee of Conservative MPs again this week. And there's a lot of people now reporting that they may have a majority in favour of changing the party rules to get rid of her, basically, ASAP. I mean, realistically, firstly, how much longer do you think she actually does have now? And equally importantly, I guess, which is really what Simon was saying, I mean, why do the Conservatives think a new leader would make anything change anyway?
Sure. So in terms of how long she's got left, I don't think it's long now, actually. And I think, you know, going back to our earlier conversation about why people are in these talks and why they're around the table, part of the strategy for Theresa May is just to keep clinging on that little bit longer. And so at the moment, she's saying to her backbenchers, you need to give me a bit more time. I'm in these talks with Labour. We could see some movement here. So that's kind of very, very much her line. But she probably doesn't have long left. And I mean, there is this question of the practicalities. So, you know, her backbenchers, the 1922 committee, they've already had one go at trying to sort of knock her off the top spot. And they don't get another formal attempt until December. But they may try and change the rules. She may also decide to go because of the pressure on her. She's been very, very much of a stayer up till now, so it's quite hard to see that happening. But there is some talk, for example, she's going to be facing an extraordinary convention of Conservative Party members in mid-June, where they will say to her they want her to go. Mm. And, you know, there's some talk about maybe that will just be the moment where she decides it's all too much, that's too much humiliation, and she will go. But it really feels like nothing's moving, and the pressure on her will build. So it does feel that kind of at some point over the summer, we may well see her go, with the idea of having a Tory leadership election essentially in time to put a new prime minister in place for October for Tory party conference. Will it change anything? No, unless, I mean, the only way I could see it sort of changing something. So, you know, I think it's very, very likely that the next Tory prime minister, because they're elected by Conservative Party members from, you know, the top two lists that MPs put forward, very, very likely it's going to be a strong Brexiteer. So we're talking about someone like, you know, Boris Johnson, Dominic Raab, someone of that ilk. And so the only way I could see it sort of potentially providing a way out of the impasse, and it's not a great one from my perspective, obviously, would be, you know, those people are much more gung-ho about a no deal. So if we get to October and nothing's changed in terms of Parliament backing a constructive solution, first of all, there becomes a question of, you know, we know Theresa May didn't really want no deal, even though she was threatening it. If there is a Tory Prime Minister who's much more gung-ho about no deal, will Parliament take the firm action it needs to properly block no deal? even if it sort of passes something that mandates, for example, you know, a Prime Minister Johnson or Raab to go and ask for another extension, they might not necessarily do it. I mean, that would plunge us into constitutional crisis. So it, with a very Brexity Prime Minister, that dynamic between
could
Parliament
change.
Could change. And then the other thing would be, well, if you've got a gung-ho Prime Minister like Boris Johnson or Dominic Raab, and we get to the point with Europe where they're saying, right, no more, you're crashing out. I don't think October is that point. I think we probably would get, I mean, it'd be interesting to know what Jennifer
exactly
thinks. I suspect, you know, that the EU doesn't want to be seen to be sort of kicking out a country, you know, against its will, who clearly hasn't got its act together. But so I suspect October isn't that point. But again, you could see how that having someone like Boris Johnson or Dominic Raab in post then, as opposed to Theresa May, would make a difference. But it certainly doesn't make a difference to parliamentary arithmetic and being able to build a coalition
or
around
get
something
a deal
constructive.
Passed. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, Jennifer, over to you. I mean, both Simon and Sonia mentioned it there. So, I mean, if Britain does need to ask for more time, will it get it, basically? I mean, Emmanuel Macron, the French president, has been very firm recently in saying no further extension at all beyond the October the 31st deadline. I mean, what are his arguments for that, and how does the rest of the bloc feel about it?
Well, Macron has been for a long time the leader of the Brexit hardline club within the EU. He's always been the strictest, and he certainly shows no sign of giving up that role. And I think for him it's very much about protecting the EU and avoiding the relentless distraction of being endlessly discussing Brexit. And what he wants is a European renaissance. This is his big project, all sorts of policies on defence and Eurozone integration to drive the EU forward. And what he doesn't want is being sort of stuck in the dark ages of Brexit and still having negotiations with the UK. But interestingly, what we did see at the last Brexit summit in April in Brussels was that he actually alienated, I think, or certainly irritated a lot of other heads of state and government. And they thought his approach was much too not pragmatic enough and not really thinking of things through from a strategic point of view. And he really annoyed other EU leaders by taking this very hard line position. And I think, as Sonia, it was absolutely right to say that the EU didn't want to force the UK out. And I think that line would probably prevail again in late October. I think there are still many, most EU member states who really don't want to force the UK out if it's seeking more time. But it is worth bearing in mind that things will be changing in the autumn, that Donald Tusk and Jean-Claude Juncker, who were both strong advocates of a longer Brexit extension, these men will both be on their way out by the autumn. They'll both be getting ready to stand down from their current jobs at the top of EU institutions, and we could be looking at new leaders coming in. And quite interestingly, at the recent summit, Barnier actually was very close to the Macron line. He was arguing that the UK shouldn't really be allowed more time, which many people see as a sort of way to gain the favour of the French president and to gain his support for Barnier's own bid to become president of the European Commission, which is something he's been interested in for a very long time.
Yeah.
Although he's not officially a candidate, something he would keep and does keep pointing out. So I think that the dynamics could be quite messy by the autumn on the EU side. It will be a little bit less certain exactly where different politicians will fall. But my hunch is that still there will be enough momentum not to push the UK out if the UK was asking for an extension and in good faith was going to pledge to be a member state and to be a constructive
a good
one.
Member state,
but I do
yes.
think the French would make it difficult, especially when it comes to things like the UK having a commissioner. That's something that the French government really doesn't want if the UK is on the way out. And that's why they were so strict on this autumn deadline. So they didn't want the UK to be coming back to the new European Commission when it's due to take office in November with a British commissioner.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
I think it could be quite a complex situation by the autumn.
Okay, Simon, the other possible outcome that we've touched on, I suppose, is a second vote, which might be one of the ways to break the deadlock. And a lot of people are starting to say, you know, this is looking like the only way out now. George Osborne the other day, former Chancellor, said it was really now the only serious option because, you know, the numbers in Parliament, as you said, simply aren't there for leaving with May's deal, but nor are they there for a no deal. You know, we know that Theresa May is dead set against a second referendum. We know that the Labour Party, half the Labour leadership is dead set against it. Nonetheless, is it a possibility?
It's a possibility, but again, it's the same problems as a general election. It's not necessarily a resolution of the problem with another vote. The first problem is, how are you going to get the votes in Parliament to hold this vote? And I see problems on both sides of the aisle. The second problem is, what's the question that we're asking? And still, we haven't, you know, I think it's been a very clever move to talk about this as a confirmatory vote, even if we can't agree how to pronounce confirmatory, rather than a second referendum, because we know that the polling is much more favourable to giving the people a voice and a say in the matter. But what are the options? Is it, again, leaving with a deal, leaving without a deal? Do we add remaining? And again, that's a very political act. And if we have more than two choices, then we have to have a method of deciding how we get to a majority. And even if we get all of this to happen, we still have a question about turnout. It's likely that we're not going to get as many people voting this time. Well, it's not certain we're going to get as many people voting this time as back in 2016. So you may end up with a situation where you get a vote to remain, let's say, but with fewer, less legitimate.
Yes.
So again, the question of process here, I think, is one that we tend to overlook. A lot of what is going on in Westminster is about outcomes. This is what I want to see happen. And how we get there is really a problem. And it's part of the reason that these new parties like the Brexit Party have done so well. You know, they're saying, look, these people don't care about you. They're just trying to do whatever it takes to get their opinion come into effect. So I think a referendum is always an option, but still the hurdles look really very significant, and the outcome of it, I think, still remains very uncertain. There's a whole question about how, you know, for those who want to remain, this is their best option, but how do you convince the majority of people to go for your option? And again, we see the difficulties that Remain parties are having in these European elections compared to the Brexit Party. Anyone who thinks that it's a cakewalk to just say, now you know more, surely you don't want to leave, is going to be in for a very rude awakening.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the Brexit Party a little bit. I mean, John Crace, The Guardian's political sketch writer, produced a frankly terrifying piece this week from a Brexit Party meeting in Pontefract?
Yeah,
I think
it was Pontefract.
And Farage has been, you know, positively sort of Trumpian in his latest appearances on the TV. Is this brand of politics now here to stay in Britain?
I think so, for the foreseeable future. So, I mean, everyone talks about, well, not everyone, but some people think, you know, Farage is an incredibly smart, savvy political operator. And there's definitely some of that. But on the other hand, what I would argue is that actually the populist playbook that Nigel Farage plays out of is pretty simple, actually. It's not complicated politics. You basically, you know, you rally against the elites that are denying the will of the people, and you say that they're really corrupt and that you offer something different, and you pretend that there are all these simple solutions to complex problems out there. So it's really, when in the right circumstances, it's very easy to be a successful populist. And that is where Nigel Farage finds himself. I think he's basically been aided and abetted by the two main parties over the last 5 to 6 years, whether that's, you know, Ed Miliband's immigration mugs or David Cameron's decision to even have this referendum on a really stupid, vague question in the first place, that actually, I think, really kind of birthed this type of very populist politics, where you've got not just politicians like Nigel Farage, but politicians like Boris Johnson, mainstream Conservative politicians back then, really misleading in a debate, because they didn't have to provide a firm option. They just, you know, could tell people, well, this is fantasy
whatever
Brexit,
they wanted,
and it's going to be amazing. So I really think Farage has been aided and abetted over the last kind of 5 to 6 years. And I think he probably is here to stay now, because I think he's got a very effective betrayal narrative. We know that the next, I think, 5 to 6 years are not going to be great politically, whatever happens. You know, as Simon's been saying, there's just no good options here. So yes, I mean, The Observer is very much in favour of a confirmatory referendum on the deal versus remaining in. That's something that we really want to see. That's not going to be particularly pretty, though. You know, if there were a soft Brexit deal, well, people like Farage would just say, even though he was kind of, you know, talking very positively about Norway just 3 or 4 years ago, he'll be saying, that's not proper Brexit. You've been sold out. And if there's a hard Brexit, but it's still not quite what he wants, and, it, you know, we know that's going to be really difficult economically economically for the country, and the gaps between London and, you know, other regions of the country are going to get much bigger. Mm. And that, again, is really fertile territory for a populist to come in and say, you've been betrayed. Mm. The reason why this Brexit hasn't worked is because the people in government, the corrupt people, they haven't delivered it in the way that I would have done. Mm. And so I think, unfortunately, the last 4 or 5 years have really given birth to a sort of dynamic in our politics, which means that I think Farage will be here to stay for the medium term. And that is just profoundly depressing, because populist politics is not a good, it's not good politics. It doesn't lead to constructive solutions. But it's really, for me, our mainstream political parties, you know, I think both leaderships have kind of really run scared of Nigel Farage. You know, and when it comes to Europe, both the Tory party and the Labour party, they swallowed the deceit of the Leave campaign, like straight after the referendum. Some people say they couldn't do otherwise. But both party leaders really pretended to the public that there aren't, you know, the trade-offs aren't too tough here. Labour saying, we can get, you know, a Brexit deal that delivers the exact same benefits of membership. Theresa May really not being up front with the public about the trade-offs involved. They swallowed that populist brand of politics, and now we are paying the price. Mm.
Okay, Jennifer, I mean, one place where Farage is pretty much certain to be, it looks like, is the European Parliament. Now, I mean, all the focus in Britain on these upcoming EU elections, that, you know, which Britain never expected to hold, but they're clearly happening all over the continent too. I mean, is Brexit beyond, you know, beyond the simple fact that, that Farage and presumably a relatively large contingent of Brexit Party MEPs will be taking their seats in July, is Brexit a factor at all in the European elections on the continent? Has it influenced the debate at all?
I'd say that Brexit has influenced how people feel about the EU, and we've certainly seen a bounce in pro-EU sentiment since the referendum in 2016, really because the British experience has been a cautionary tale for anyone arguing for exit, whether that's the exit of their country or exit from the Eurozone and the Euro. So you see, for example, Marine Le Pen, she's gone awfully quiet on talking about Frexit and leaving the Eurozone. In fact, she now says that's no longer her policy. You've seen that the Sweden Democrats, the far right party, they no longer talk about Swexit. They've said, well, looking at the experience of the UK, we need to see what happens for the first country that does try and exit before we argue for that as a policy. And you've seen in the EU's polling done by Eurobarometer that pro-EU sentiment is now at its highest levels since before the Eurozone crisis, since autumn 2009. You've seen more and more countries saying EU membership is a good thing, where a majority of people are saying it's a good thing. Now that's now in 21 countries, up from only 13 a few years ago. So I think across the board, we've seen a rise in pro-EU sentiment, and that's largely because of Brexit. But whether that really sort of carries over into the vote at all is hard to say, because, of course, people are voting on national issues.
Yeah.
Above all, and European referendums, European elections are traditionally a referendum, if you like, on a national government. On, you know, do you think the government is running the country in a good way or not? So often voters use these elections as a way to sort of kick their government if they're unhappy. Mm. And also turnout has been a problem in the past. Turnout has been falling across the EU ever since the first direct elections to the European Parliament 40 years ago. So although there are hopes the turnout could increase this time around, that's not being taken for granted. So I think it's possible to overstate the influence of Brexit. And these are still very much 28 separate national elections within a European context. But Brexit is part of that mix for all these different countries.
Okay, we'll speed up a little bit because we're starting to run out of time. Simon, I'm just interested, the new European Parliament is certainly going to be, the one thing we are almost sure of is that it will be much more fragmented. The main centre-left and centre-right blocks will be losing votes. There's going to be an increased presence on the sort of the populist hard-right, mainly because of Salvini's League MEPs from Italy. In that sense, is British politics simply undergoing with a bit of a time lapse, the same process of fragmentation that we've seen on the continent for some years now?
there's certainly an argument that you're kind of seeing this Dutchification, as some of my colleagues refer to it, that you get more and more parties. The constraint always in British politics is the electoral system. So for European elections, it's much more understandable because the proportional system on the regional lists does allow for much more diversity. In Westminster, first past the post still is a really strong pressure towards those two big parties because that's the most efficient and effective way of doing it, which is why there's so much fighting within those parties to control those parties, because that's the way to break through. And, you know, if we think back 5 years ago to the 2014 elections, UKIP came first in those elections. That was a really strong result for them, a very bad one for the Conservatives. And then less than a year later, they came back and won a majority in Westminster. So I think we have to be careful about separating what happens in European elections from what happens in Westminster. And there's not an automatic transmission and rollover.
Yeah, Sonia, do you agree with that? I mean, the latest polling's putting the Brexit Party on something like 20% in a Westminster general election. Does that feel sort of remotely right?
I mean, I think we have to treat it with some caution because it's a brand new party and they've never been tested in a general election format. And so it's hard to know whether, and you know, there have only been a few polls about general election voting intention that have included the Brexit Party, so it's hard to know what will come to pass. So will voters just think, you know, I want to send a clear message, like this is sort of strongly voters, Brexit hasn't happened, I'm going to vote for the party that does what it says on the tin. That's conceivable, but then you may also get some voters who think strategically and think, well, if it's a close Tory Labour seat and they may be natural Conservatives themselves, well, if I vote for the Brexit Party, I might let the Labour candidate through. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty about how that dynamic's going to play out. So I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't necessarily go off the back of this, but I do think it's conceivable that the Brexit Party will do, you know, will do double figures, for example. I think they'll be coming off the back of a very successful European election campaign. And I think it probably will raise questions again about our electoral system. I mean, no one really likes or enjoys talking about our electoral system and whether it's fit for our times. If it doesn't feel like the sort of the answer of sufficient scale to the sort of fragmentation of politics we see. But, you know, whether you're talking about parties of the left or the right, if you see parties getting millions of votes in a general election and none or very few seats, that does kind of beg the question. And I think our first past the post electoral system, it works very well in delivering stable majoritarian government when you've got an electorate that's divided along one spectrum, a left-right spectrum. Once you start to introduce a new division that cuts across that left-right spectrum, which is essentially what we've got with Brexit and Leave Remain, the party system just doesn't work anymore. That's why you've got the two main parties split on this really important issue. So at some point, I mean, you've got to start asking questions. Is our electoral system really fit for purpose with a sort of newly fragmented electorate?
Okay, Jennifer, last question to you. You know, the outcome of the European elections could also, and what kind of parliament emerges in Strasbourg and Brussels, you know, could have some kind of influence over Brexit, couldn't it? You know, it's looking likely, as I said, that parliament's going to be much more fragmented. There's going to be more populist EU-critical MEPs. That might mean coalitions are more difficult to build, to get sort of legislation and direct new directives and through. And of course, as you mentioned, there's going to be a new commission. And there will be British MEPs in there voting and possibly influencing outcomes that'll put last long beyond Britain actually leaving, if it ever does. How important could all of that be in the future of Brexit, do you think?
I think fairly important, but I wouldn't overstate it. Potentially, we could see perhaps 30% of the seats in the new European Parliament being taken by anti-EU populist parties. But I still don't think these MEPs would be able to stand in the way of ratifying the Brexit agreement, assuming, of course, that it was agreed in the UK. So, for example, you could see Matteo Salvini and his League party coming back in greater numbers, Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party. But typically, these anti-EU parties, they're not always very good at uniting with each other. So they're not always very good at joining forces. And you'd still have a majority, well, on the current polls, at least, of so-called pro-EU parties, the traditional centre-right, centre-left, the Liberals, the Greens. And so they would be able to sort of manage the numbers in order to you know, to keep the Brexit process running smoothly. I think the bigger impact could be on the member states, could be on EU leaders. So if you're Emmanuel Macron or Angela Merkel, what lesson do you draw if there has been a big surge of for anti-EU populists in the European elections? Does that mean that you take a stricter line with the UK if they're asking for another extension? So I think potentially maybe there the impact is greater rather than in the Parliament itself.
Okay, excellent. Right, well, I said that was the last question, but I've actually got one very quick one to all of you, as is now tradition. Next Brexit means going to be a month from now, mid-June. Will anything have changed, Sonia?
No, possibly something might happen with Theresa May before that meeting of the extraordinary Tory membership convention that I talked about. Mm. But no, nothing apart from that will change.
Okay, Simon?
No, nothing will change. I mean, you'll have the results of the election, the European election. Everyone will claim that this is a vindication of their position and why they are right and they must prevail, with the net result that will be where we are now.
Okay. And Jennifer, you agree with that, I imagine?
I mean, sorry to make it all consensual, but yes, I think nothing will have changed, and Brexit will be continuing as sort of uncertain and as murky as ever, although perhaps with a bit of a political crisis in the UK following the European elections.
Okay, something for us all to look forward to. Well, that really is it, I'm afraid. For this time, my thanks to Sonia, Simon and Jennifer. We'll be back with a fresh dose of Brexit bedlam, as I said, in mid-June. Please do subscribe, review on all your favourite podcatchers, join the discussion on Twitter, you just need to search for Guardian Podcasts. If you want to get in touch with us, it's Brexit Podcast. That's all one word, brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. Till next time then, I'm John Henley. The producer was Susanna Trezillian. This was Brexit Means, and thank you very much for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.